U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement does not target unlawfully present aliens for arrest based on advocacy positions they hold or in retaliation for critical comments they make. Any suggestion to the contrary is irresponsible, speculative, and inaccurate. ICE focuses its enforcement resources on individuals who pose a threat to national security, public safety, and border security. So, Will, can you respond to that, to what ICE has said?
Well, it's demonstrably false, both in the case of migrant justice and also nationally. This lawsuit is one of a number happening around the country right now by immigrant community leaders and human rights defenders who have been unfairly targeted by ICE in retaliation for First Amendment activities. From New York to Washington State to Mississippi, immigrant leaders have been targeted by ICE in a de facto national policy of retaliation. But I should say that this campaign against migrant justice predates the Trump administration. This was happening in 2016 under the Obama administration and continues to this day. So in some ways, we see that migrant justice leaders may have been a canary in a coal mine, showing what would be to come under the Trump administration.
Will Lambeck, we want to thank you for being with us, organizer of Migrant Justice, a Vermont-based group founded and led by immigrant farm workers. We will follow this lawsuit against ICE and DHS and the Department of Motor Vehicles. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for internships in our education, Spanish, outreach, and social media departments. The deadline to apply is today. You can go to democracynow.org for more information. Again, the deadline is today. These are paid internships here in New York City. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Woronoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Ndura, Tamer Yass Studio, and Libby Rainey. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. You can see our video and audio podcasts at democracynow.org, as well as transcripts. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Yemenites, Girls Bringing the Light at our KBOO at the Clinton Monthly Film Screening on Thursday, November 15th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Yemenites, Girls Bringing the Light is a feature film telling the story of three girls and their entrepreneurial skills in a nation whose reputation includes being one of the worst places to be a woman, the poorest country in the Arab world, and a failed state. It explores challenges of youth unemployment, drug abuse, and a struggling education system. Again, that's Yemenites, Girls Bringing the Light, at our KBOO at the Clinton Monthly Film Screening on Thursday, November 15th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
The time is 5:03 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin & Levine, LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin & Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levinandlevine.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, there is a new proposal for a ferry crossing from Portland to Vancouver, Washington on our horizon.
Florida is holding a hand recount for the senatorial race because of faulty voting machines.
And in international news, a splinter group of the migrant caravan heading through Mexico that identifies as LGBTQIA has reached the border in Tijuana and plans to apply for asylum in the United States.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 15th, 2018. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Teresa. A third burgerville in southeast Portland has announced that it will be unionizing. They are on board to join the first federally recognized fast food workers union in the nation. The union is using their bargaining power to push for a $5 raise for all Burgerville workers, affordable health care, safe working conditions, paid parental leave, and transportation stipends, amongst other items. The Burgerville Workers Union webpage stated that, quote, "We are fast food workers, mothers, fathers, students, grandparents. We are young and old. Every day going into work, we're made to feel that we're at the bottom of the American economy. We make near minimum wage and struggle to make ends meet. People say, it's fast food. What do you expect? But no one should expect to live in poverty," end quote. The Burgerville corporate office has until Friday to respond.
As right-wing militias return to Portland this Saturday with their hashtag Him2 rally, KBOO's Teresa Mitchell offers this commentary.
Today, the nation's chief demagogue spoke in his usual devious terms about his favorite social enforcement mechanism, the white militias that now infiltrate the armed forces and the nation's police. Here's what he said, quote, "These people like the Antifa. They better hope that the opposition to Antifa decides not to mobilize, because if they do, they're much tougher, much stronger, potentially much more violent, and Antifa is going to be in big trouble," end quote. Trump hates opposition with a blind fury because he has been rich all his life, and since he was quite wee, he has had his whims catered to and his opinions lionized. He is confused and frightened by dissent, therefore he hates dissent, and he has always wanted to crush it. To that end, he has been sending dog whistles and direct commands to his followers to abandon polity and to commence a reign of violence. In his campaign rallies, he directed the mob to attack dissenters and promised to pay for legal representation for those who would strike his foes. The Capitol Police, taking his earlier commands as precedents, arrested thousands of people protesting his inauguration, charging them with false and outrageous crimes, so that many of them stayed behind bars for years until the courts were forced to acknowledge that they had been framed. When the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville turned murderous, he blew the dog whistle again, saying there were fine people on both sides. So consider now more of his words on that topic spoken to the fascist publication Daily Caller yesterday. Quote, "These people, like the Antifa, they better hope that the opposition to Antifa decides not to mobilize, because if they do, they're much tougher, much stronger, potentially much more violent, and Antifa is going to be in big trouble. But so far," Trump hedged, perhaps sensing that he needed to soften his directive, quote, "they haven't done that, and that's a good thing," end quote. Trump has made it clear that the leaders he loves are the leaders who draw blood from their own people. The attack on Antifa is a Trumpian command to the fascists in the police to attack. We know this from inductive logic, if nothing else. He is the nation's highest executive authority, and when he says these things, his followers have attacked, making bombs, killing Jews, killing people of color. He has set the stage by declaring himself a nationalist after carefully branding himself as a white supremacist. He is demanding a civil war, a Pinochet-style reign of terror in which his answering police and military and racist enforcement gangs beat and shoot the target population into submission. And make no mistake, the target population is us. His aim is against the majority, against all persons who are not straight, conservative, white, cis males. And if there could be any doubt that he was sending his message to the fascist elements within our trusted protectors, he also said this, quote, "Because if you look, the other side, it's the military, it's the police. It's a lot of very strong, a lot of very tough people, tougher than them, and smarter for them," end quote. Trump said that, and he said, "They're sitting back and watching, and they're getting angrier and angrier," end quote. In that last phrase, Trump is saying to the police that their hatred of dissent is legitimate, and that they may now act on that fury. The grand juries, disproportionately white males due to the longstanding economic and social advantages of that group, will also continue to answer that call, dispensing absolution to murdering police, like the white men who this past week blew away a black hero who had stopped a mass shooting despite his uniform, despite the crowd that screamed at them to stop. Why do white conservative males act in this way? forgive me if I answer my own question, it is because they cannot conceive of the new world that is forming around them, in which their pale skin and their masculine status no longer translates into a range of privileges, from jobs and wages to immunity from suspicion and search. Because they cannot imagine it, they fear it as one fears prison and death. Because they have enforced their privilege through a system of oppression and retribution, they themselves expect retribution when the change comes. This Saturday, one of Trump's favorite militias is coming to Portland again to punish us for our progressivism. This time, the conceit is that the women who have launched the Me Too movement are oppressing men by falsely accusing them. Fortunately, Antifa will be on hand to reduce the cowardly little scenes that always accompany these events, in which the fascists surround one small person, usually a person of color, and take turns stomping that person as a group. Fortunately, Antifa will be on hand with antidotes to the police and fascist pepper spray canisters, which will be deployed to bring pain and punishment to anyone displaying dissent and defiance against our new terror overlords. Here's what Rose City Antifa has to say about it. On November 17, 2018, Saturday, Patriot Prayer member Haley Adams is holding a misogynist and rape apologist rally in downtown Portland, co-hosted by Patriot Prayer leader Joy Gibson and Quincy Anatello, a member of the Christian extremist group, the Hell-Shaking Street Preachers, uniting the event's messaging under the hashtag #HymnToo. Adams and Patriot Prayer are producing propaganda that pretends there is an epidemic of false rape allegations against men equivalent to or exceeding in volume and severity to the horrifying realities of sexual harassment, rape, domestic violence, and murder of women and non-men in our society. The violence and the reliable presence of neo-Nazis and other fascists at Patriot Prayer events has already been well established by Rose City Antifa and other media outlets. Not only is the premise of a #HymnToo rally ridiculous on its face, the behavior of Patriot Prayer, Proud Boys, street preachers, and other associated far-right and white nationalist groups, both on the streets of Portland and in their private lives, shows that they are the exact sort of threat described by the concept of rape culture. Antifa writes, men are certainly also victimized by the sexual and domestic violence and rape culture. However, Haley and Patriot Prayer's usage of the #HymnToo hashtag has overwhelmingly ignored the possibility that men might be victims of violence in favor of simply triggering the libs and publicly mocking and discrediting any claims of sexual violence. The event on November 17th is sure to be one more iteration of right-wing public harassment from Adams, Patriot Prayer, and the street preachers as they threaten, abuse, violate, dehumanize, and incite violence against marginalized people. That's from Rose City Antifa. President Trump has drawn the battle lines, and it is too late to speak of reconciliation. Which side are you on? Speaking for myself, I'm Teresa Mitchell. A local company called Frog Ferry is in the first stages of developing a new plan for a ferry from Portland to Vancouver, in order to decongest the already problematic and soon to be even more problematic area of the I-5 bridge. The proposed ferry would move between the two ports during its first phase, with hopes of then opening to other areas of the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, eventually opening up ferry service to parts of the gorge to also relieve congestion on the I-84 freeway. Susan Blatholm is one of the forces behind this new traffic innovation and has yet to reveal the specifics, so, she says, as not to impede the future progress of this plan. Currently, the Port of Astoria is also working on restoring their old ferry service by 2020. As of now, the only working ferry on the lower Columbia River is located between Puget Island, Washington, and Westport, Oregon, and takes about 15 minutes five times a day. The ferry is located in an area that is over 20 miles from any current bridge crossings.
Florida's votes in the midterm elections will now be counted by hand. The recount was mandated by Secretary of State Ken Detzner and will take several days. The outcome is expected to remain unchanged for the Senate race, as the Republican candidate, Rick Scott, is ahead by some 12,000 votes. However, if a major flaw in machine counting is discovered, it is possible the seat could go to Democrat Bill Nelson. The shift in technique is being put into practice after a five-day machine recount of more than 8 million votes. President Trump has weighed in with what has become a usual trope, claiming without evidence that the election is skewed by imposters who change clothes and return to revote. In related news, Democrat Jared Golden was declared the winner in Maine's 2nd congressional district. His win means that no Republicans from the New England states will appear in the House of Representatives next year.
The Public News Service is a member-supported media outlet that highlights issues outside the frame of the mainstream news and aims to keep the media honest. On today's roundup, Stormy Daniels lawyer Michael Avenatti has been arrested on charges of domestic violence. An anti-protest bill is being considered in Ohio. Reformed West Virginia drug felons are blocked from receiving SNAP benefits for life, and what life after coal could look like in coal-dependent economies.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, November the 15th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford.
Lawyer Michael Avenatti arrested on a domestic violence charge. Also on the Thursday rundown, more testimony on the so-called anti-protest bill. Plus, we'll take you to the Dakotas to celebrate American Education Week. Now our top story, Michael Avenatti, best known for representing adult film star Stormy Daniels, arrested in Los Angeles Wednesday on allegations of domestic violence. The Huffington Post reports the LAPD confirmed the arrest in an email to the Huffington Post, but said that he had not been booked. The Post notes that Avenatti denied the allegations. He said, quote, "I've never been physically abusive in my life, nor was I last night." He added, "Any accusations to the contrary are fabricated and meant to do harm to my reputation. I look forward to be fully exonerated." There was a packed house on Wednesday at an Ohio Senate hearing on a bill that could silence a form of free speech.
Senate Bill 250 would tighten the state's laws regarding trespassing and property damage involving oil and gas pipelines and other industrial infrastructure. The legislation is similar to many bills in other states in response to the 2016 protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline. Guy Jones is a Native American from Dayton who testified in opposition. He contends SB 250 intends to impede on the rights of citizens.
The right to gather and to voice their opinion in opposition to the things that are happening in our backyards, in our communities, in regards to the threat against Mother Nature, against the land, the water, the air.
Supporters say the measure would strengthen protections for critical infrastructure and discourage demonstrations. But opponents counter that the bill's language is vague and could result in the criminalization of peaceful protest through felonies and excessive fines. I'm Mary Sherman reporting. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation.
Reformed West Virginia drug felons are blocked from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. Dan Hyman reports there's a call for legislation to fix that.
West Virginia is one of only three states that has a lifetime SNAP ban for anyone convicted of a drug-related felony. That applies to Debbie Colby of Huntington, even though she has finished her sentence and broke her addiction to meth more than 2 years ago. She says it's unfair that no matter how long she stays clean or how long she keeps her job, she can't get the help any other kind of felon can the day they leave prison.
Murder and armed robberies and all that stuff, and you can get help all day long. If I needed help with food, they absolutely will not. Even if I had young children, I could not get food stamps. They could, but I can't.
The lifetime ban was put in place as one of several measures designed to get tough on drug crime. Colby says they want the legislature to reconsider it in the next session.
A new report shows that with a little innovative thinking, there can be life after coal by repurposing abandoned coal mine sites. More on that from Tramell Gomes.
It's all designed to help showcase how areas can build a new economy in the decline of the coal industry. The report by Reclaiming Appalachia Coalition identifies 20 projects in the region that, if funded, could bring new life to those communities. One idea for Dickerson County includes building an outdoor adventure resort on a reclaimed high wall to draw tourists. Another idea is building a solar farm in Southwest Virginia. Jacob Hanna with the group Coalfield Development in West Virginia says the coalition's plan is to inspire local leaders and entrepreneurs to get people back to work.
Maybe if we start working together and put out the progress that we have been observing and creating, then maybe it will inspire other people to do the same as well, and we can start moving towards what can be created as a best practice for answering the question of abandoned mine sites.
Some of the projects in the report received funding from Congress through the Abandoned Mine Land Pilot Program, which appropriated $105 million in 2017 and $115 million in 2018.
A new data brief from the N.A. Casey Foundation shows young people in foster care nationally and in the state of Mississippi are struggling as they transition to adulthood. Mississippi's director for First Place for Youth, Clara Graves, says teens in foster care face difficulties with education, employment, and housing.
You see young people that are really doing incredible things, too. I know a lot of young people who are working two jobs, going to school, and doing the hard work that it takes to be successful and how we can support them in that.
21% of the foster care population in Mississippi are age 14 or older, and 22% will age out of the system before finding a permanent home. And finally, Ros Brown reports South Dakota's children attend school for 6 to 7 hours each day, 180 days a year, and it takes a dedicated contingent of specialists and support staff.
This is American Education Week, acknowledging that every child, regardless of where they live or their circumstances, deserves the opportunity to succeed in school. Mary McCorkle is president of the South Dakota Education Association and says the impact of public education is lifelong.
Public education is the great equalizer, and it doesn't matter what a child's zip code is. Every child deserves the best public education possible, and that ensures that we have a democracy.
The average ACT college admission composite score for South Dakota students is up slightly this year from 2017 and remains above the national average.
At 84%, high school graduation rates in the U.S. are at an all-time high. More than 4 out of 5 high school students earn a diploma in just 4 years. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for Sojourner Truth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, stay tuned for Queen Talk. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low near 43. Today in history, in 1969, 250,000 protesters descended upon Washington, D.C. to protest the Vietnam War. The quote of the day is from Bobby Seale, who said, "You don't fight racism with racism. The best way to fight racism is with solidarity."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, a Massachusetts tribe is finding support for its march and rally in Washington to urge lawmakers to pass legislation on tribal land trusts. Senators on the Committee of Indian Affairs have passed legislation on missing and murdered Native American women called Savannah's Act. And the Navajo vote is getting an extension after they were severely affected by ballot shortages. Here's more.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Leaders from tribes across the country joined members of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe Wednesday to march and rally in Washington, D.C. The Massachusetts tribe is urging U.S. lawmakers to pass legislation for its reservation. The Interior Department in September issued a decision that it could not hold land into trust for the tribe, reversing a 2015 designation. The bill reaffirms the land status. Videos posted on social media by Native organizations and tribal leaders shared the march from the National Museum of the American Indian to Capitol Grounds, where a drum group offered a song. Tribal leaders spoke about unity and standing together for land rights. President Fawn Sharp of the Quinault Indian Nation.
I stand here in honor of the tribes that are directly impacted by this now. That includes all of us. Whether you think you're directly or indirectly, we are all directly impacted by this decision, and we all need to stand together because that is where our strength lies.
Some U.S. lawmakers also spoke in support of the bill, including its sponsor, Congressman Bill Kading. Tribal leaders and their allies say they'll continue to pressure the Trump administration and Congress to protect tribal rights. Also in Washington Wednesday, senators on the Committee on Indian Affairs passed legislation addressing missing and murdered indigenous women and girls. Savannah's Act requires the Department of Justice to develop guidelines for cases relating to missing and murdered Native Americans. It's named after Savannah LaFontaine Graywind from North Dakota, who went missing in August 2017. The 22-year-old was pregnant at the time she disappeared. Her body was found 8 days later near Fargo in a river. She was murdered by a couple in an attempt to steal her child. The child survived and is with the father. Senators say the bill is to help other cases like Savannah's by improving the response by law enforcement and other agencies and access to data. North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp sponsored the bill.
The crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women is too often unknown outside of Indian country and too often forgotten. I've been working to change that because the people inside Indian country understand this epidemic, levels of violence against Native American women, and we cannot continue to ignore it. And so in October, I introduced this legislation, hopefully, which will be a good first step, not the end product that we need, but definitely an effort to bring awareness and an effort to get down to some data collection that we think will make a huge difference, and also provide that immediate response to women who have gone missing.
Heidkamp, who lost her Senate seat in the midterm election, will not see the implementation of the bill. She urged her colleagues not to let the issue slide. The advancement of the bill came on the same day as a new report was released by an urban Indian group on the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women in U.S. cities. The bill now goes to the full Senate for consideration. Navajo voters who were impacted by ballot shortages on Election Day will be allowed extra days to vote. The Farmington Daily Times reports the tribe's election board authorized the extra days. Voters can inquire about casting a ballot now through November 21st. Confusion over a ballot initiative is one of the reasons the election administration has given for the shortage, which resulted in the reissuing of ballots at some polling places. The election board has dismissed the election administration director, saying the office needs new direction. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A group of about 80 migrants from the migrant caravan slowly marching through Mexico has reached the border of the United States and is currently biding their time in Tijuana. This group of migrants, which identify as LGBTQIA, splintered from the main caravan after experiencing prejudice and discrimination not only at the hands of locals but also by other members of the caravan. Cesar Mejia, a member of this group, stated in a press conference that, quote, "Whenever we arrived at a stopping point, the LGBT community was the last to be taken into account every day. So our goal was to change that and say, this time we are going to be first," end quote. The group hopes to apply for asylum in the United States based on the fact that they are victims of violence and oppression due to the widespread homophobia and anti-LGBTQIA violence in their home countries.
The Middle East Minute Plus is brought to us by Jewish Voices for Peace and KPFK. They provide daily roundups of the latest news from the Middle East. On today's episode, House Republicans blocked a vote that would have ended U.S. military support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen.
I'm Esty Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. Yesterday, House Republicans blocked a vote on a resolution that would have ended all U.S. military support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. They did so by approving a rule for floor debate on an unrelated bill that stripped the Yemen resolution of the privileged status it held due to its sponsor, California Representative Ro Khanna, having invoked the War Powers Act upon its introduction in September. Khanna, commenting on the House floor about the maneuver, said, quote, "Let's be very clear. This is unprecedented in American history. What the majority is saying is that if the President of the United States and the Speaker believe we should be in war, we should be at war," end quote. Republicans argued that Khanna's resolution was unnecessary after Friday's announcement that the U.S. military would no longer provide aerial refueling for Saudi coalition planes, one of the most visible and controversial aspects of U.S. support for the coalition, ignoring that the United States provides the coalition other logistics and intelligence, as well as billions of dollars in arms sales. They added that Democrats could revive the issue when they take control of the House in January. Representative Khanna went to the floor to argue the imperative not to wait until January, noting that 500,000 children will die in a matter of months because they don't have aid or nutrition. Khanna added that when the history of Congress is written, it's going to say that Congress did not allow a vote while hundreds of thousands of kids were not allowed food and medicine. On Democracy Now! Today, Representative Khanna pointed out that Jamal Khashoggi's last column in the Washington Post called for Saudi Arabia to end their barbaric campaign in Yemen and linked it to his murder in the Saudi embassy in Turkey on October 2nd, saying, "We honor Khashoggi by stopping the war in Yemen." This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 15th, 2018. Here are the main points once again. A Southeast Portland Burgerville is looking to join the nation's first federally recognized fast food workers union. Florida is holding a recount for the senatorial race, and Republicans in Congress have blocked a vote that would have ended U.S. support of the war in Yemen. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is me, Teresa Mitchell. The producer is Grace Ann Smith, and our engineer is Mike Dynamite Fitoklis. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Teresa.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, and on Positively Revolting. Guest hosts Leila and Jenka put the focus on Gaza and with Dr. Yasser Abu-Jameh, director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. At 9, Veterans Voice deals with the after effects of war with Northwest Veterans for Peace. At 10, Valley Views talks to artists working with CEI Artworks in Corvallis. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Radio Zine features a presentation from the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Training Team on resource extraction and disaster capitalism. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on donate.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Republicans in the House of Representatives successfully blocked a bipartisan resolution that would have ended U.S. involvement in the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Tens of thousands have been killed and up to a million people are under threat of starvation. 113,000 children have already died from hunger and the cholera epidemic in Yemen, whose spread is spreading as a result of the Saudi blockade, is already the worst in recorded history, with close to a million people affected. Meanwhile, Donald Trump touts his mega weapons deal with the Saudis while turning a blind eye to Saudi atrocities. Our guest is Robert Naiman, Policy Director at Just Foreign Policy. And CNN has filed a lawsuit against Donald Trump's White House. Concerns are growing about freedom of the press in the United States. Donald Trump has consistently gone after members of the press who are critical of his policies and who call out the outright lies and misinformation he feeds to his supporters. The implications are far-reaching, especially considering the growing divide in the United States. Our guest is Jeff Cohen, journalist, media critic, and the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, known as FAIR. It's a U.S. media watchdog group. For our weekly Earth Watch, the fight over palm oil, we speak with Jeff Conan, who directs the International Forest Program for Friends of the Earth U.S. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. We don't have our news headlines today. We'll just take a short music break here, and then we will go to our first guest. Thank you. Alrighty, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. On Tuesday, November 13th, CNN filed a lawsuit against Trump's White House, claiming the revocation of Latinx journalist Jim Acosta's press pass to the White House violates the constitutional rights to freedom of the press and due process. As you may recall, Acosta confronted Donald Trump during a White House press conference on Wednesday, November 7th, following congressional elections. He pressed Trump on a racist campaign ad that ran ahead of Election Day, later asking him follow-up questions about his racist depictions of the ongoing migrant caravan as a quote-unquote invasion. Trump later accused CNN of reporting fake news, saying, and pointed at Acosta, saying, "You are the enemy of the people." Acosta was silenced and had his press credentials taken away. CNN is asking for an immediate restraining order to return Acosta to the White House. And on Wednesday, November 14th, Fox News, NBC, CBS, and other major news outlets filed friend of the court briefs in support of the CNN's lawsuit. Others supporting the CNN suit include AP, Associated Press, Bloomberg, First Look Media Works, Gannett, the National Press Club, Journalism Institute, the New York Times, Politico, Press Freedom Defense Fund, EW Scripps Company, USA Today, and The Washington Post. But Bob Woodward, the legendary investigative journalist who helped expose Richard Nixon's Watergate scandal, said he's not joining his colleagues in support of Acosta. Woodward instead attacked CNN, arguing that too many media figures, quote unquote, have become emotionally unhinged. Now, domestically, Trump's attacks on the media have disproportionately targeted black and brown journalists. This includes Acosta, who is Latino, and three black women journalists who also asked about his rhetoric. The three women, Abby Phillip, April Ryan, and Yamanichi Alcindor, earned his contempt apparently just for asking him questions. Trump called one of Phillips' questions stupid, described Ryan as a loser, and brushed off Alcindor, saying her question was racist. Abroad, Trump's war on the media takes the form of turning the other cheek to Saudi human rights violations, such as the organized killing inside a Saudi consulate in Turkey of a Washington Post journalist, Jamal Khashoggi. So let us go now to a little montage of Trump's attacks on reporters of color.
On the campaign trail, you called yourself a nationalist. Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. Now people are also saying
that
the president...
I don't know why you'd say that. That's such a racist question. You just have to sit down, please. Sit down. I didn't call you.
You want him to rein in Robert Mueller?
What a stupid question that is. What a stupid question. But I watch you a lot. You ask a lot of stupid questions. The same thing with April Ryan. I watch her get up. I mean, you talk about somebody that's a loser. She doesn't know what the hell she's doing.
Thank you, Mr. President. I wanted to challenge you on one of the statements that you made in the tail end of the campaign. In the midterms, that
here we go.
That, well, if
let's
you don't
go,
mind, Mr. President, that this caravan was an invasion. As you know,
I,
Mr. President,
I consider it to be an
as
invasion.
You know, Mr. President, the caravan was not an invasion. It's a group of migrants moving up from Central America towards the border with the U.S.
Thank you for telling
and
me that.
Why did you characterize it as such?
Because I consider it an invasion. You and I have a difference of opinion.
But do you? They're hundreds of miles away, though. They're hundreds and hundreds of miles away. That's not an invasion.
I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN.
All right.
And if you did it well, your ratings would be
ask,
much better.
If I may ask one other question. Mr. President, if I may ask one other question, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President, I was going to ask one of the other folks.
That's
had,
enough.
Pardon me, ma'am.
That's enough.
Mr. President, I had one other question, if I may ask, on the Russia investigation. Are you concerned that you may have?
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation?
Mr. President,
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. Go ahead.
I think that's unfair.
You're a very rude person. The way you treat Sarah Huckabee is horrible. And the way you treat other people are horrible. You shouldn't treat people that way. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jim. In Jim's defense, I've traveled with him and watched him. He's a diligent reporter who busts his
butt. Well, I'm not a big fan of yours either, so
I understand.
To be honest.
So let me ask you a question, if I can. You repeatedly said you are the best. Mr. President, you repeatedly, over the course
okay,
of
okay, just sit down, please. Well, when you report fake news, no. When you report fake news, which CNN does a lot, you are the enemy of the people. Go ahead.
You are the enemy of the people. I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Jeff Cohen, journalist, media critic, former journalism professor, and the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, known as FAIR, which is a U.S. media watchdog group. Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you in a dark time for freedom of the press.
I'm telling you, I mean, setting aside what one thinks of Jim Acosta, it just seems, I don't know, I had never heard of the media coming together and having to sue the White House for access, and then the attacks on women, black women in particular. Shut up, you're stupid. Yeah, sit down. You know, it's a stupid question, you know, that kind of thing. Jeff Cohen, what is happening here?
Yeah, I don't think there's any other explanation except that Trump has a special animus toward female journalists of color. I mean, it's obvious he's been on a warpath against journalists, period, but the contempt and the statements that he makes and the immediate interruptions when Yamiche Alcindor of Public TV asked a very good question about whether Trump's invoking the term nationalist was emboldening white nationalists. It was after Ku Klux Klansman David Duke had applauded Trump for calling himself a nationalist. It was a very good question. There was nothing racist about it, even though that's the accusation Trump immediately made in cutting her off. By the way, he never answered the question. And then out by the helicopter, when Abby Phillip asks another good question, whether the appointment at the Justice Department of Matthew Whitaker would be, used to rein in the Mueller probe, and then Trump reacts, "What a stupid question! I watch you a lot. You ask a lot of stupid questions." There's no doubt that there's a particular animus there toward African American journalists, in my view. But to me, Margaret, the context for Trump's war on media has to be, you know, I've watched him being in New York for decades. For decades, Trump has been a media creation. You know, Trump is in many ways a media creation. He had soft coverage for decades in the gossip press, in the business press. You had NBC Entertainment created The Apprentice for, I don't know, about 14 years for Trump. And so he was used to a media that promoted him. And even up through 2015, when the broadcast TV networks and the cable news channels, including the allegedly liberal ones, were giving him so much free coverage every time he stepped to a lectern. So the war hasn't, you know, the war began in 2016, and I think it's because Trump was used to a media that promoted him as it promotes so many people who are rich and famous and powerful. So it's really interesting to see the switch in Trump's mind beginning, I would say, in early 2016 and escalating in the last few days. Trump seems to be having a meltdown in the wake of the midterm elections. He's just melting down.
Yeah, and it does seem, too, just at the start of Trump's race, and even before that, when he took out the full-page ad in the New York Times about the Central Park Six,
sure,
basically saying they should die, be given the death penalty, and also him, you know, attacking Mexicans, what a late colleague, Antonio Gonzalez said about him, that a kind of a cold war against Mexicans, you know, they're rapists, they're so I don't know if he expected that the mainstream media would kind of just go along with the program and not really challenge him, especially seeing the growing divide around race, but not only, you know, with his comments after Charlottesville, et cetera, et cetera.
I think that in those years that led up to him running for office, he'd gotten such mamby-pamby soft treatment from big media that he didn't understand that things would shift. And I would argue, after he descended the escalator and made those outrageous comments against Mexican immigrants and immigrants from south of the border, the media were still really soft, giving him a mic. He had this privilege. There were, you know, 20 other candidates for president. All the other candidates had to get to a camera if they wanted to be interviewed on TV. Donald Trump, as a candidate, could literally phone it in. He would call in to Don Lemon at CNN. He would call in to CBS morning show. He could just call in, and they'd put his photo up. And that was a privilege. He did that about 20 times, and no other candidate had that privilege. So there was this soft treatment, and the war began when reporters started treating him as a political figure, and as a political figure that had a propensity to lie.
Yeah, and it's kind of chickens come home to roost. I mean, I personally feel that the mainstream media, they helped Trump get elected, because anything he did, the man would blow his nose and it would become headline news, right?
Yeah. You could quantify this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ABC World News Tonight, in the first 11 months of 2015, when, you know, primary candidates, the thing they need the most is television coverage. And Bernie Sanders, during that 11 months, got a total of 20 seconds, one-third of 1 minute, while Donald Trump got 81 minutes.
Mm.
You can go from network to network and see the special privilege that Trump got. So it wasn't until 2016 that the war began, and that's when Trump's lies just stacked up and stacked up. You know, this suit that you mentioned that was, they had a hearing yesterday, CNN v. Trump.
Yeah.
A two-hour hearing. It's before a Trump-appointed federal judge, Judge Kelly. I'm not optimistic about it. They're seeking a temporary restraining order that would force the White House to immediately give Jim Acosta that pass, the hard pass that allows him to go on the White House grounds that the Secret Service had taken away on Trump's orders. I'm not optimistic about it, but there is a suit that hasn't got as much attention, which was filed last month by PEN America, the writers group. And it talks about, and that suit distinguishes between, you know, says Trump's got the First Amendment right to attack journalists, to criticize journalists, but he doesn't have the right to use federal agencies or departments to retaliate against news outlets and their owners because he doesn't like their coverage. So that lawsuit, to me, has more legs. It's about all of the threats that Trump has made, where he would use the Postal Service or the Justice Department or the Federal Communications Commission or the Secret Service to retaliate against news outlets that he does not like. That's an interesting suit that goes more toward the danger of Trump. That, you know, Trump saying mean things about journalists and you're stupid and you're a loser, which is what he said to April Ryan, another black woman of American Urban Radio. You know, those mean things he says to me are not as important as his use of federal agencies to bottle up the press. And the most important use of federal agency is Trump's Federal Communications Commission. The biggest freedom of the press issue, in my view, is Trump's Federal Communications Commission moving against net neutrality, which would allow the Comcast and the Time Warner Spectrums and the AT&T and Verizon to take websites like Democracy Now! And Pacifica Radio and KPFK and push all those websites into the slow lane while allowing websites that these internet providers own or like and push them in the and put them in the fast lane. That's another dangerous use of an agency that will really hurt freedom of the press if Trump succeeds.
Right, so a multi-pronged attack here. I wanted to talk a little bit about the wider implications, though, of this attack on the press. I mean, in terms of the race stuff, we know, you know, I'm of African descent. When we heard the nationalist thing, we knew he was sending not a dog whistle, but a foghorn to his base to say, yeah, I'm a white nationalist, right? And of course, nationalism has another also negative meaning in Europe, which Macron called Trump out on. But given the fact that these 13 mail bombs had gone out, including not only to Democratic supporters, but to a media outlet like CNN, Trump pointing to somebody like Acosta and saying, you are the enemy of the people, and personalizing it, there really is a lot of danger here in terms of death threats and other, you know, et cetera, that against journalists and the double standard. Imagine if this was the behavior of Nicolas Maduro of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. You know what I mean? Or if it was some other country that the U.S. doesn't like, there would be hell to pay about freedom of the press.
Right. Jeff. This would be evidence that they're an authoritarian regime that the U.S. should be ready to overthrow or subvert. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel for these journalists, you know, they go out and cover rallies. Trump is sort of a nonstop campaigner. And when you go out and cover Trump on the road and his followers are out there and they've been inflamed by Trump's lies and Trump's attacks on the journalists and specific journalists and specifically journalists of color, I think he's creating a very dangerous situation for the lives and health of these journalists. It's unprecedented in modern U.S. history, and people who have covered Trump rallies, journalists who have covered Trump rallies, have talked about the level of anger and threats that they encounter, and it's not that way when they go and cover other news events out among the public. There's nothing quite like covering a Trump rally. There's some interesting video of the reporters, and of course at each Trump rally, Trump says, you know, those people out there, the enemies of the people right there, and he points them out. It's unheard of. It's not what a president in a democratic society, that's not how someone acts. That's how an authoritarian or a dictator acts. And it truly is something that's dangerous for reporters, mainstream or independent.
Yeah, and also, finally here, the hesitancy to ask a question. I mean, think, you know, right at the start after Trump got elected, I mean, I was so fed up listening to lie after lie after lie, reporters sitting there like sheep to me, not really challenging anything. And I must say, whatever one thinks about Jim Acosta, people accuse him of grandstanding, etc. You know, he has gotten up there and kind of jumped into the fray and stirring the pot a little bit, but I just didn't know why they didn't even bother to boycott those.
Well, that's the issue. You're hitting on something that's important, that the reporters have not worked together enough. Why do they let the president decide who gets chosen?
That's right.
Why isn't that done by the reporters themselves? All right, Mr. President, the next question is going to such and such from such and such media. I mean, this is sort of interesting that a bunch of media outlets have gotten together to support CNN. But there isn't a level of cooperation that a small D democratic journalist group needs to stand up to power, whether it's political power or corporate power. So, I mean, that's the problem, is the journalists do not work together to defend freedom of the press. You hear a lot of that sentiment from independent journalists, but not so much from corporate mainstream journalists.
Yeah, and hesitancy to ask a question, because they're going to figure, well, am I next to have my credential pulled? So,
well, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And there's not enough supporting of each other when someone does ask a tough question. Like, if I had been out at that helicopter where Abby Phillip, the young African-American reporter from CNN, asked a very good question, and she's told what a stupid question it is, the next reporter should say, Mr. President, I want to follow up. I want to ask you exactly what Abby Phillip just asked you.
That's right.
It's a good question. That hasn't happened much.
Right. Well, Jeff Cohen, just a former journalism professor, journalist, media critic, founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Thank you for joining us. This is going to continue, so I'm sure hopefully we'll be able to have you back soon. Thank you, Jeff.
That's great, Margaret.
All righty. We are going to take a short station break now. And when we return, our weekly Earth Watch and also the crisis in Yemen.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
We are amazed but not amused by all the things you say that you do. Concerned but not involved with decisions that are made by you. But we are sick and tired of hearing your song, telling how you are gonna change right from wrong. Cause if you really want to hear our views, you haven't done nothing.
You haven't done nothing. You think Stevie Wonder is singing about Donald Trump? This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Thank you, Mr. T, for pulling that up. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, if you've missed any part of this hour, go to kpfk.org. You could also subscribe for a free podcast. You can also check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, look and friend us on Facebook. We're also on SoundCloud. And today we would like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners in West Virginia, and internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the entire region of the Middle East. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, analysts have made the point that the roots of civil war in Yemen that has taken tens of thousands of lives came out of the 2011 Arab Spring that swept the region and alarmed governments and monarchs in the region, as well as the United States. Thus far, 113,000 Yemeni children have starved to death as a result of the war. And Yemen, which is the most impoverished country among Arab states, had, even before the Arab Spring, long suffered from divisions exacerbated by Saudi Arabia's support for the Sunni majority in that country against the minority Houthis. A stronghold of the Houthis is on the Yemen-Saudi border. The Saudis also supported the repressive government of Ali Abdullah Saleh. The Houthis responded by solidifying a political movement named Ansar Allah. When, due to protests and the Houthis managing to capture a major Yemeni city, Saleh fled the country and holed up in Saudi Arabia. He was replaced by his a colleague of his, really, Mansour Hadi, who was also backed by the Saudis. The conflict was further escalated when Hadi proposed a federal system in Yemen which would have blocked the homeland of the Houthis from the Red Sea. And now, just about 5 years later, Yemen has the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In addition to the hundreds of thousands dead as a result of the war, the UN warns that if the Saudi US-backed blockade continues, up to 1 million people in Yemen will starve. And a cholera epidemic spreading as a result of the blockade imposed by the Saudis has affected close to 1 million people, making the deadliest cholera outbreak in modern history. Of course, drone attacks ramped up during the Obama administration, allegedly to stop al-Qaeda in Yemen, continue, and with weapons from the U.S. or bought with money from the U.S., Saudi Arabia continues to bombard Yemen. Just a piece of breaking news just in is that the Saudi-led coalition has halted its assault on the Yemeni port of Hodeidah, and this was following international pressure. Now, Trump has made much of his huge weapons deal with Saudi Arabia, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has a bromance going with the Saudi crown prince. So, also, just yesterday, I think, Republicans in the House of Representatives successfully blocked a bipartisan resolution that would have ended U.S. involvement in the Saudi-led
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
It's coming. It's almost here.
It's the next GiveGuide Big Give Day, Thursday, November 15th. There's no wrong time to give to KBOO. KBOO has real people making live radio all day, every day.
But when you give to KBOO in the Give Guide this Thursday, November 15th, you'll be entered into a raffle to win a Tender Loving Empire vinyl package, plus a year's worth of Laughing Planet.
If you're 35 or under, you'll also be entered into another raffle for a second gift package.
Go to kboo.fm/give on Thursday, November 15th to contribute.
That's kboo.fm/give this Thursday for your chance to win.
Support KBOO.
Where music makes the movement. Tune in
and turn up.
You are listening to a digital indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios and decolonize.